This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. Good evening, everybody. This is Nate G, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. How are you doing, Dr. Lyle?
Very good. Good to hear your voice again.
Thank you. It's good to hear your voice, too. We're coming in on the new year. And a couple shows ago, we talked about free will.
You had mentioned that you don't believe that there's such a thing as free will. And it's really interesting that you mentioned that, because I came across an article on the Atlantic magazine. And the name of the article was titled, "There's No Such Thing as Free Will, but we're better off believing it anyway."
Right.
And apparently scientists, what they did was they had a couple of different experiments where they showed each control group, they just left them as they were. And the other group, they showed them pretty definitively that there was no free will. And then they observed their behavior and wanted to see how their life changes after they find out that there's no free will. And it turns out, according to this article, they're saying that people are better off not knowing if there's no such thing as free will, because they're more likely to just assume that they've got no choice, so they might as well just give in to a lot of their negative parts of their personality.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's fascinating. That's a great study, actually. I will have to read what it is that these guys did. But and of course, that isn't necessarily the case, so they clearly didn't necessarily give this information a fair shake. So they painted the issue of not having free will in a particular manner, obviously, to get the result that they got. If they painted it in a different manner, they would have gotten a different result. In other words, so the issue is that the brain can't – when I say that there's no free will, this is specifically what it is that I mean. What I mean is that you can't help what you think, and your thoughts are actually the determining feature of your feelings and also the determining feature of your behavior. And so you don't have a choice as to what you think, so this is going to indicate that you don't have free will. But what happens is that what your thoughts are going to depend upon is going to be dependent upon the analytical mechanisms that reside in your mind. And these things are automated mechanisms. And so part of the automated mechanism is going to be, for example, to believe things that are told to you by a credible source. So in the absence of no other information, if somebody tells you that the water in the pool is very cold, you have no reason not to believe it. So your free will doesn't say, well, I believe that with my free will, I'm going to believe that that's not true. I believe the water's warm. You can't. Okay? Your brain says that somebody that is credible, i.e., maybe it's a friend of yours, and that friend is completely non-psychotic and has no penchant for practical joking, and you saw them just stick their hand in the water, and then they say to you, whoa, the water's cold. And in fact, there's reasons why it might be cold. That makes sense to you, then you don't have a choice as to believe that the water is cold. Okay? So this is why it is that you don't have a choice as to what to believe. However, the way your mechanisms work is you believe credible sources. Well, if a credible source says that you don't have any such thing as free will, and essentially paints the picture that the implication is that you can't do anything to modify your circumstances to change your behavior in a positive direction relative to the direction that they are now, then you have bought into a series of implications for the, quote, no free will that are incorrect. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So no free will doesn't mean that you cannot learn and correct your understanding of the world and therefore improve your functioning. That's not what no free will means. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out that they slanted the concept of quote no free will in a credible way, but in an inaccurate way. And as a result, the individuals got inaccurate information. And as a result of that inaccurate information, they then did not their brains made incorrect inferences about the nature of reality, and therefore they behaved in a way that was not as conducive to survival and reproductive success as it would have been had their brain had a more accurate understanding of reality, which indicated the fact that there was a potential to do things differently, and et cetera. So this is how you have to understand what it is that we're talking about, and more clearly and accurately. And that's what I mean by the idea that you don't have free will. You don't have a choice as to the inferences that you make. That you cannot stop yourself from making the inferences that you're making, but you can actually continue to learn and improve the accuracy of your thinking with additional information. And so knowing that that is true, which is in fact true, and your brain, once you get evidence of that, can recognize that as a fundamental principle, then that brain can have encoded in it that says, ah, there's more to learn and I can learn more. Okay. Now, some philosophers would say, well, what the hell is the difference between that and free will? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say there's a lot of difference, because the free will would say that I could believe in anything. And I'm saying, oh, no, you can't. Okay. What you can believe in, and therefore you will have feelings and behavior that are based upon your thoughts and feelings. Your thoughts, feelings, and behavior are an integrated stream that goes from the analytic engine of your brain into the feeling mechanisms that signal the implications of the analysis, which then result in the behavior that you do. So that is what the psychology of an organism is information into the system, analytics, and then emotional reactions, and then behavioral output. So you don't have a choice about that, but you can. But that doesn't mean that the efforts of your mind at gathering new information do not improve its functioning and therefore improve its accuracy and therefore have potentials for improving its functioning.
Yeah, I think maybe we should have the authors of the study listen to our show. What do you think?
Yeah, clearly. Clearly, they bias their results in a particular direction, and it's interesting that they did, but they didn't. They did not actually fully understand how to do the study properly.
Yeah. All right. Well, we actually have a caller who called in the show, and
mm-hmm.
she has some questions for you, Dr. Lau. So let's put her on right now, and then let's see where this goes. Hi, caller. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
Doing good. What's your name?
Sarah,
welcome to the show. It's Nate and Dr. Lyle.
Very good,
thank you,
Sarah.
And thanks, Dr. Lyle. It's nice to meet you. I've really enjoyed listening to your podcast and to both of you being on the show, so I'm excited to chat with both of you about this. So I'll give you a little bit of background about my theoretical understanding, and
mm-hmm.
I have a couple questions for you, because the first time that I had heard about evolutionary psychology was through the show. And I'm
mm-hmm.
actually a board-certified behavior analyst, so when I heard your explanation of Skinner and Walden 2, it was really impressive that you had such a comprehensive understanding of, you know, determinism and, you know, some of those concepts related to free will.
Mm-hmm.
My question for you, and this is just without any understanding of kind of the, I guess, evolution of evolutionary psychology, is how does the field, I guess, use the scientific method to kind of prove a lot of the theories that you've talked about on the show? Is there like a journal that I can look at, or, you know, how do you kind of determine that a lot of these things actually exist, you know, in our current phenomena, since it's so hard to prove the genesis through the ages?
Oh, well, I would say that's a big question. And, so I'm not sure sort of what level of detail that you would need and how comprehensive an understanding that you would need. So let me at least give you some, and then you might ask me sort of more specifics about this, or I can give you some specifics to help you understand. The way to look at psychology is to back the camera up. So we can then look at the scientific method, and we can talk about scientific method in a little bit. But the way to look at psychological phenomena is to actually look at it in a whole comprehensive continuum, or what we're going to call consilience of knowledge. And so what we know about the universe is limited in some ways by what the kind of a creature we are. So there's certain things that we can understand, and it turns out we can understand a tremendous amount of things with great levels of probability. So let's talk about this. So for example, we have a pretty deep understanding at this point in time relative to other points in history of physics. So that means that we can make systematic observations in physics, and we can make predictions about how we would expect things to behave based on what we now understand about quarks and protons and neutrons and gravity and so forth. So we've got four known sources of energy in the universe, et cetera. So we've got these sort of processes that we understand, and we make observations, et cetera. So we can essentially say that we have identified, to the best of our knowledge, universal truths about the nature of physics. Now, it's going to turn out that there's certain kinds of stuff in the world that lends itself to, molecules. So we're not just talking about particle physics. So when we start talking about bigger things, a whole element or a whole atom, we start talking about the concepts of chemistry. So we see that and we're going to find out that, of course, the principles and observations in chemistry cannot be in violation of any of our accurate understanding of the laws of physics. So if we see anything that's in chemistry that is in violation of the laws of physics, we know there's a contradiction here that has to be resolved, that there's something that we don't understand. So by and by, it's going to turn out that what we would consider laws of chemistry never violate the laws of physics. And if we go on, we're going to find out that there's a certain class of creatures, or actually we could talk about another field that we would call biochemistry. So there's going to be chemical processes involved in living things, and it's going to turn out that the biochemical processes, if we want to call them that, are not going to violate the laws of chemistry, and they're not going to violate the laws of physics. And then we're going to start talking about the nature of biology. So the nature of biology, a living thing, that thing has certain ways that it operates. It's a certain type of matter, and it's organized in a certain way with a certain specific purpose. And it's going to turn out that the laws of biology, as we start to see that these living systems have certain properties to them, and we're going to call those laws of how it is that they work, the laws of biology cannot violate the laws of chemistry, which cannot violate the laws of physics. And then it's going to turn out that a certain percentage of these things, living things, are going to have a mechanism called the brain. And that brain is going to be an exceedingly useful tool for certain organisms in order to be able to regulate movement so it is that they can move in ways that are advantageous for survival and reproductive success. So that is going to be the purpose of a specific organ in biology that's called the brain. So it's going to turn out that the laws of psychology, how this thing is designed and how it works, the nature of its operation, cannot be in violation of the laws of biology, okay? Which are not in violation of the laws of chemistry, which are not in violation of the laws of physics. So now we've arrived at psychology, and we have it now what we're going to call nested it's nested in a whole host of observations that go all the way down to particle physics, and they're going to come all the way up through political science and sociology, et cetera, and anthropology. So there's nothing about the behavior of political systems that is going to actually defy the laws of psychology as we come to understand them. Okay, so it's going to turn out that the psychology of different animals is going to be somewhat different. So in this particular case, we've got a human being. Now, evolutionary psychology is the only perspective on the map in the history of psychology that actually puts psychology, the study of this organism, and particularly the human organism. But we don't have to be talking about humans. We could be talking about the psychology of any specific species, or we could talk about workings of mind in general. That it's the only perspective that puts this study, the science of it, and our understanding of it firmly within biology. Psychology is a subset of biology. Now, this perspective, by the way, is not shared in the history of anthropology or sociology. So these folks don't actually get it. They don't actually understand that their field, when you start talking about groups of people, that there's nothing in groups of people that is anything other than the individual neurological activity of individuals. Okay? The fact that one individual's neurological activity is impacted by the behavior of another individual is not relevant here. There is nothing that is taking place outside of the brains of a group of individuals when they are behaving together. Those individuals are a bunch of independent points of consciousness, and the fact that they share some ideas, they have similar thoughts and feelings, does not make them a new entity. They are not a life form of their own. Okay? So this is a fundamental misunderstanding that has for 100 years, the social sciences have actually sought to divorce themselves from biology, and this is guilt. Psychologists are guilty of this, and sociologists are guilty of this, and anthropologists are guilty of this. They actually don't want to actually have the ideas of these fields integrated in biology, but this is a mistake. They are all integrated in biology.
So the theory that you're talking about right now about psychologists trying to dissociate themselves from biology, where is that? Like, where can I read more about that? Because some of your concepts are so interesting, and I want to learn more about them. And I'm trying to figure out, is there a book on it? Is there, where can I figure out whether that, learn more about whatever those concepts are?
Yeah, if you read, for example, Freud, you'll find that Freud actually was attempting to break psychology away from biology. So
I think we can all agree, as a psychologist, we can agree that Freud is not what guides modern-day psychology. I mean, it's certainly what prompted psychology to become popular. As a behavioral psychologist, we've learned so many things that kind of, show that Freud is very antiquated. So maybe the type of psychology that I study is a little more evolved past Freud.
Right.
And I did study in Vienna where, in Europe, wildly, Freud is very, very well known. But I would say, most psychologists have kind of moved away from the Freudian approach, I would hope. That's what I would like to see more of. So from a behavioral perspective, I'm trying to figure out whether the more evolved perspectives have some type of, whether the evolutionary perspective has, I guess, more empirical research to show that some of those theories are either using like randomized controlled trials or even subject design. But is there something I can read, to learn about those in a more scientific manner?
Okay, if you're actually trying to ask whether or not evolutionary psychology and perspectives are grounded in empirical science, the answer is overwhelmingly yes. Okay.
Yeah, so that's what I'd love to learn more about.
Oh, no problem. Okay. So for example, even 20 years ago, there was a handbook of evolutionary psychology published by Oxford University Press that has over 1,000 pages in it. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So this is, it's been updated multiple times. You will find that there's major encyclopedias of evolutionary psychology with thousands and thousands of citations from thousands of investigations that have been published in the top leading empirical journals. So there's no end to the observations that have taken place from evolutionary psychology. And so what I would help you to understand is that there isn't any other perspective that has been even close to as successful in predicting and finding support for the theoretical positions. So when you look at the history of behaviorism and behavioral analysis, et cetera, whatever you want to call it, what you're going to find is a series of horrendous failures. So, for example, let's go back 100 years to the dawn of behaviorism, and what you have is the very basic concepts coming out of Pavlovian conditioning that then lead to John Watson's famous thesis that you can essentially reward and punish an individual in childhood into becoming any kind of character that you want. So that's a famous quote from if you've studied this field, then you know that that's a famous quote from a seminal paper published in 1913 called Psychology as a Behaviorist Views It. And it's going to turn out that it was a beautiful thing, how he wrote his paper and how he said that he essentially could turn anybody into anything by essentially a reward and punishment history that he would administer to the individual. Now, the great virtue of some of the behaviorist writing and thinking is that they are so easy to prove wrong. So by 1985, the concept that you could modify people's personalities with rewards and punishments would absolutely crash on the rocks behind the investigations of behavior geneticists who would find in monozygotic twin studies that that is not true. Okay? So you can read the work of the behavior geneticists, Abe Telligen, Thomas Bouchard, a whole bunch of other people that clearly essentially laid waste to the behavioral view of the modification of personality characteristics by any kind of behavioral paradigm. So this is also, it's obviously been shown to be a total failure in terms of trying to change people from gay to straight or straight to gay or anything else that you would want to do. So if you're wanting to actually know and get a feel for the extraordinary amount of research that supports this position and how beautifully this lines up, you can go to those major, you can go to major textbooks. So, for example, if you want to look at a textbook that will give you a comprehensive look at evolutionary psychology, David Buss is a professor of psychology at the University of Texas at Austin. He's published a textbook that's now, I think, in its fifth or sixth edition. It's called Evolutionary Psychology, The New Science of the Mind. And you will see, again, thousands and thousands of references for investigations in from an evolutionary perspective that essentially show the overwhelming superiority of this perspective. The behavioral perspective...
I just pulled up his book and I can see some of the concepts that you're talking about here. So this is exactly what I was looking for. I remember because for my undergraduate, I was a neuroscience major, and I remember one of the studies that stuck with me the most, which is genetic related, was the study where they were trying to figure out whether alcoholism is genetic or not. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. So they had a cage of rats, and they had a water fountain that was just water. They had a water fountain that was just alcohol. And then they had a water fountain that was a mix of alcohol and a mix of water. And they observed the rats, and they figured out which are the ones that are more likely to only drink water. So rats that are more likely to only drink the alcohol, and the ones that kind of went between all three of them or kind of relied on the middle one and went back and forth. And so then they took those rats and they grouped them into what they call the non-drinkers, the alcoholics, and the social drinkers. And then they mated the alcoholic rats together to see whether their babies would then fall in particular categories. And they were able to then kind of show that, you know, alcoholism actually does get handed down genetically because of their children. There was a higher probability that those rats would be more likely to be alcoholic down the road. I remember those types of studies really resonating with me. And so a lot of the times when you talk, I get excited about what you're saying, and I love those examples. And if you have any really interesting examples about that are more human related, I think that would be really interesting to hear about.
Great. Yeah, well, like I said, if you're interested, the studies done in behavior genetics, there's actually a journal called Behavior Genetics So literally every month there will be study after study after study after study published on exactly these kinds of topics that are
mm-hmm.
showing the major contribution of genetic variation to the behavioral observations that we see in people. And there's a lot of nuances to this, and it's an ongoing sort of open-ended scientific area within psychology. So that's just, I wouldn't even call behavior genetics exactly a part of evolutionary psychology. It sort of is. It's sort of its own thing.
Mm-hmm.
Evolutionary psychology is a little bit broader, and evolutionary psychology is the notion that the mind was evolved for the specific biological purpose of survival and reproduction of DNA. And
mm-hmm.
that is a perspective, when you bring that perspective in and understand that the human mind was shaped by evolutionary process in the same way that a gopher's mind was. So there's certain reasons why gophers do gopher things, because they've got a gopher body and they have gopher ecological problems that they have to solve. It's going to turn out that every animal has a mind that shaped perfectly to solve the problems of its evolutionary history. That's why the organism
mm-hmm.
has that specific mind. This just to sort of give you what a revolution this is, in the 1960s, a behaviorist, or actually a psychologist, studying a key component of a behaviorist paradigm, his name was John Garcia. He was at UC Berkeley. And I don't know, are you aware of the Garcia study?
I'm not.
Okay, this is
Which one is that?
No, this is an important study. This is an important study in the history of psychology. What happened was that the notion in sort of standard behaviorism is that if you reinforce or punish an act, then or you pair an act, you pair something with a reinforcement or punishment, you're going to increase or decrease its statistical likelihood of occurring. So in the case of Garcia, what he did was he actually tested this in an interesting way. In theory, if you feed a rat a novel piece of food and then you give it an aversive stimulus at the same time, then this should decrease its likelihood of eating that food. So what he did was he fed them a novel food, and then he had very noisy buzzers and flashing lights that were extremely unpleasant for the rats while
mm-hmm.
he was presenting the food to them. It turns out that when he then fed them the novel food later, they didn't have any problem eating it and they liked it. So in no way were they able to be conditioned by punishing the rats or making it an aversive situation while they were eating. Okay. However, then what he did is he took the rats and he fed the rats this novel flavor of food. And then several hours later, he irradiated them so that they felt sick to their stomach. Okay. So now the important thing is that there's been now a 5 or 6 hour, even 12 hour, and even 24 hour difference. Now in standard behaviorism, sort of the laws of learning are such that the temporal difference between the stimulus onset and then what happens later is going to be of all importance. But it turns out it's not important at all, not if you understand this from an evolutionary perspective. Because it turns out that if you radiate those rats 24 hours later and they get sick to their stomach, they'll never eat that food again.
Mm-hmm.
So
isn't that just an example of classical conditioning? Like I know Seligman
talked about that,
the Soss-Bernays syndrome.
No, wait a second. Yeah, I understand. But this is not classical conditioning. You have to understand that what's happening here is that the rat is biologically prepared to learn certain contingencies but not biologically prepared to learn other contingencies. So
mm-hmm.
You have a novel food and you have a current aversive stimulus. Okay? So you have noise and lights that it can't stand. It turns out it will not associate that novel food with that aversive stimulus. There's no way to get that to learn it. It cannot learn that
mm-hmm.
contingency. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's very important for us to understand that. Whereas it turns out that if it's a different behavior that it's going to do, so it steps on something and then it hears a buzz, it can learn that. Okay, it's capable of learning that, but it's not capable of learning novel olfactory stimulus or gustatory stimulus with an aversive stimulus through a different sensory channel for a different adaptive problem. Now, this represents an important revolution in thinking. It turns out that this was so unpleasant for behaviorists that they denied Garcia's work, and they wouldn't allow it to be published. Okay, they stopped its publication on numerous occasions, even though this is a big shot professor at Berkeley. And in fact, one of the reviewers said that that's no more likely to be true than there's bird shit in my cuckoo clock. Okay, in other words, it was so outside of the paradigm of behaviorism that it was unacceptable. Okay, but finally, what happened is after multiple submissions and a lot of pressure, they actually had to finally concede. So now this is the dawn of the death of classical behaviorism through B.F. Skinner and the concepts of operant conditioning. This is now showing that only through an evolutionary perspective can you understand that the nature of the learning that takes place winds up being innate. So when you have learning take place, it's a very wise question to ask something that the behaviorist never asked, which is, what instinct caused the learning? Now we're down at the roots of evolutionary psychology. What is this organism capable of learning, and what is it not capable of learning? So evolutionary psychology is the investigation as to the nature of the instincts of the human mind. Okay? And it turns out that only by, you know, looking at this thing from this perspective, that's the only way you're ever going to find them. So that's why we.
Yeah, I'm going to read up on this because I've never heard of this study, and I've taken a lot of coursework on behavioral psychology and classical conditioning and all that stuff.
Yeah, somebody left it out. One of the most important studies in the history of psychology. Okay.
Yeah.
Very good.
So would you say this is a good example of the type of studies that exist that kind of support the evolutionary perspective? There's a lot out there if I look at that evolutionary psychology
handbook. You know what?
There
are so many different studies. As I said, there are thousands of them. So therefore, there's no end to the ways that evolutionary psychologists look at these problems. So they're using exactly the kinds of things that if you are well-versed in science and you're well-versed in social science, they will use all kinds of – every scientific method that you can imagine is at play here. And so there's no reason to wonder whether or not that if evolutionary psychology is on a solid scientific foundation, it's on as solid a scientific foundation as any scientific process that's taking place on Earth. Okay?
Great. Thank you.
All right. Very good.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Excellent. Well, Sarah, thank you very much for the phone call. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right.
All right. All right, Dr. Well, thank you very much. That was really informative. I don't know enough to know all these little studies to question you on, so that was a really good perspective.
Yeah, it's going to turn out that it was a very good question, and clearly she's got a skeptical slant because she's been educated in a different perspective in psychology, and so she's, like many psychologists, she's simply unaware of the magnitude of what we call the nomological net. So when we do science, what we're doing is we're actually building a network of interrelated observations. And this is what's known in the philosophy of science as a nomological net. So this net is, if you think of it, as you start drawing little lines between little observations all over a wall, you can start to see that the more complex or the more observations that you get that are identified, you're sometimes going to see observations that contradict other observations, and that's going to be a little question mark that's going to be sitting out there in science, like how come we have two observations and they appear to be in contradiction? And so that's going to stimulate science to try to figure out, did somebody misunderstand or misreport or have an anomalous finding that is not actually consistent with the truth? They just didn't happen to get a truly random sample, so we've got a rogue observation here that really doesn't line up with the truth. The i.e., we took a sample of short people and they have tall children, and that's not supposed to happen. So what the hell happened? Okay, it's supposed to be that tall people have tall children and short people have short children. And we have a group of 20 people here. It didn't seem to work out. What happened? And we look at that and we say, well, it was statistically significant. It looked like it happened, but that doesn't mean that it's not a rogue observation that actually won't be repeated if we do the study numerous times. So as we continue to make observations, what we do is we build a net or a network of different observations that start to link together patterns of causality. And so this is how it is. You can imagine that this is how chemistry would have worked. So first you find one element, and then you find another element, and then you find something called a molecule, and you're not sure what that is. And then as you continue to put a table of elements together, and you start to understand how it is that they differ from one another reliably, and then you start to understand finally a little bit more and a little bit more about, you know, valences and electrons. And now you can start to see which ones bond together and which ones don't bond together and how it is that they bond and then what sorts of things can break those bonds. So if you have water and you boil it at 212 degrees, it turns out that you can break these bonds, et cetera. So as you start to do this, what you start to do is you build the more and more observations that you get, then you start building a net that starts being able to essentially predict things that you cannot see, okay? So this is where you know you have an extraordinarily mature science that can start to predict things that you cannot see based on things that you know, okay? Now, this is what evolutionary psychology can now do, and that is why those of us that are in it, that have actually watched its genesis and now its maturation we call it evolutionary psychology, but as the originators of this field formally, who are John Tooby and Lita Cosmes, the University of California, 100 years from now, we won't call it evolutionary psychology. We're just going to call it psychology. Okay, this is what psychology is. And the nomological net that has been built on evolutionary psychology is now vastly surpasses any previous attempts that human beings have ever had to try to understand themselves or the nature of the psychology of any animal. So this is that's why you need to look at an anthology or a compilation like what David Buss has done and others have done, as you get to see the extraordinary power of this nomological net as it makes predictions that no other theory in psychology could ever even dream of predicting.
Yeah, so, yeah, no, this is great. I mean, I guess it's, there's a lot, you know, like you've been saying, it's evolution of psychology. It really is just psychology, right? It's just, and it should be called revolutionary psychology.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly a revolution, and what there has been in the history of psychology is you've had sort of major attempts by groups of thinkers or individual thinkers at a perspective where they worked very hard at this to try to build a nomological net. And so when the psychodynamic people in the early 20th century tried to build a net of observations, it turns out that they couldn't predict anything worth a darn. And so as a result, you know, most of that got left by the wayside. But it isn't that they didn't have some interesting observations. They did have some interesting observations. But it turns out that the theories behind them about what they thought that they were seeing or why those things existed turns out to be incorrect. The same thing is true of a standard behaviorist paradigm, which has a few what we call laws of learning that are actually correctly describe and predict certain narrow phenomena. So the thing that a behaviorist is used to looking at is they're looking at schedules of reinforcement and learning curves. And those things are real things. So if you do, for example, rat maze learning, and so you're going to put cheese in the middle of a rat maze and you're going to make it X complicated or you make the cheese tastier, et cetera, you can predict a learning curve based on the reinforcement of this that makes perfect sense, and the behaviorist looks at this thing and writes this thing up, and these people are smart people, and they were really desperately trying to figure out and build a nomological net so that they can make predictions ultimately about humans, so et cetera. Now, what they wouldn't have predicted would be, for example, an evolutionary perspective would say, I wonder what else would work for reinforcement other than a piece of cheese. And somebody might say a mate, okay? A behaviorist might say a mate. But here's something that a behaviorist wouldn't come up with, but an evolutionary psychologist did. An evolutionary psychologist predicted that in the middle of a rat maze, that if you have a male rat learning to run the rat maze, that in the evolutionary history of male rats, it turns out that something that reliably precedes mating with a female is winning a fight with another male. And in order to win a fight with another male, you got to have another male to fight. So an evolutionary psychologist with a behaviorist background actually predicted and found in an experiment, and this is a fantastic experiment example of the nomological net, that he says, okay, look, in the evolutionary history of a rat, a rat's wants to mate, of course, but it also, in order to mate, it has to fight. So I wonder if I put a male rat in the middle of a rat maze. I wonder if I put a male rat in the middle of a rat maze, whether or not we will see a learning curve that is anything like the learning curve that we see if we put cheese in the middle of the rat maze. In fact, he's going to predict that it might be better because, in fact, mating with a female that would happen subsequent to a fight with a male rat, even if there's only a 50-50 chance of winning that fight, is going to be more evolutionarily valuable for the reproduction of genes than a piece of cheese. And it turns out that's true. So completely unpredicted by any other paradigm in psychology that wouldn't have even dreamed of this, evolutionary psychologists consider the possibility that putting a male rat in the middle of as the reward of a rat running a maze would result in a superior learning curve to putting cheese in there, and it does. Okay, so that's
I should go out to the bars before I take exams. Is that
I don't know what that means, but that's sort of an example out of the nomological net. Okay, and there are literally 1,000 of such examples that have now been observed and found. As soon as, of course, as I would have expected this to take place for me, is that I discovered this after I had my PhD. So as a lot of research grad students trying to figure out a PhD topic, I worked like hell to try to figure out a PhD topic, and I did, and I eventually got my PhD. But I could almost never come up with a decent idea that would work or that would be that novel or interesting. After I saw evolutionary psychology for the first time, after I already had my degree, my realization was, oh, my God, how easy is this? Suddenly you have a network of concepts that you are going to be able to have completely virgin territory in science since nobody was looking for these ideas. And suddenly from this perspective, you're going to be able to see potential investigations all over the map. And of course, that's exactly what has taken place. So when it comes to man-woman dynamics, David Buss, for example, doing investigations in evolutionary psychology looking at the jealousy mechanism, no other theory in psychology would have predicted that there would be a substantial difference between male and female reactions in jealousy situations, that it didn't make any sense from a behaviorist or psychodynamic perspective that there would be any difference between males and females. But David Buss predicted that the females would be much more worried about males defecting a relationship, where a male would be much more angry and wanting to leave a relationship entirely if a female was unfaithful, because his costs of remaining in the relationship would be greater, because it would mean that his potential mate was being impregnated by somebody else, and therefore this cost would be astronomical biologically compared to the female, whereas if your mate steps out on you and sleeps with somebody else, at least the child that is within you is yours. And so now it's an issue of resources to get from the male. It turns out that experiments that he's done in his laboratory have demonstrated this very precisely, that the male and female jealousy organ mechanism inside the mind works very differently if you're a male or a female. Males are much more hostile, angry, and willing to leave a relationship instantaneously as a result of infidelity. Females are much less likely for that to happen. So that's once again one of thousands of observations that have come to us out of the new nomological net, which is evolutionary psychology.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.